want to poop more, this is the episode for you then. Getting right into it with the constipation episode. What do you think, Amy? Should we help these poor people poop more?
Yeah.
Assuming that they don't have diarrhea.
I would love that. Woohoo, let's do it.
Let's start off. So usually I ask you, where do we start? But I'm going to make a suggestion this time. Let's define constipation, because I find that a fair amount of people are constipated and they don't realize it.
Right.
So I actually have some bullet points written down for this even. So I think the one that most people understand is if they poop infrequently.
Right.
And I was looking this up for this episode, and I think the technical definition is fewer than 3 poops per week.
Yeah.
And that paints one picture. But like, what about the people who poop every day, but they're only pooping like a little marble, rabbit turd kind of looking thing? That's not good either.
Yeah.
So you could also go by, you know, stool quality. Are they hard and dry and small? Do you feel like you're not evacuating your bowels completely? If you're having those little marbly rabbit turd looking poops, you probably feel like you have something left in there, right? So that's another indicator. And also, you could have decent looking poops, but if you have to work really, really, really hard for that and strain a whole ton, and if they're straining and pain every time you have a BM, that could also be constipation, even if the poop looks good and you're technically having one every day.
Right.
So many flavors of constipation.
Well, yeah, I think the like straining piece, some of these different like types or how it's presenting could also provide some information as to what to focus on too. Because, you know, I think if there's like a lot of straining, you know, there could be a pelvic floor or like a neuromuscular element that you need to work on. I think they call it dyssynergic defecation. Have you heard that term before?
Yeah.
And again, I've definitely had some clients that fall into that realm where it feels like, oh, it's like right there, but I've just like can't move it from like rectum to toilet. I think you're right. And one other thing I'll add too is I do see sometimes in the holistic functional space, or I have seen it, where people will be like, if you're not going 3 times a day, you're constipated. I don't know if you've heard that before too. Which again, I think there's no real evidence for either. And again, like I think there's probably a amount of pooping that is best for your body too, which is something to consider as well. Some people might feel best going 2 times a day. Other people might feel best going 1 time a day. I don't necessarily think that I wouldn't say that you're constipated unless you go 3 times a day, like I've seen in the holistic space.
Well, and that kind of reminds me of stuff that we talked about in the truth about functional medicine episode. And that to me screams, oh, they're trying to scare you so that you think you have something to treat, so you go in and spend money with them. Right? Like, you're going to capture more people and get them to care about their gut health if you scare the people who are pooping once or twice a day and you tell them that that's bad.
Right.
I will throw out this other one, since we're talking about bullshit from the functional medicine space. I get really short-tempered when I hear the idea of toxins building up if you're not pooping. And like so much else, there's like the littlest grain of truth to that, or I get what they're trying to get at, but you can't tell people that they're toxic and they're building up toxins if they're not pooping, because some people take that way too far and it freaks them the F out. And I worked with a lady not all that long ago. She was really deeply troubled and like obsessive about that. And she would get royally freaked out if she didn't poop every single day. If she skipped one day of pooping, she would wig out. And she told me, I'm building up toxins and I'm toxic and my colon is toxic if I'm not pooping every single day. And I was like, whoa. Like, I told her straight up, you need to get that out of your brain as quickly as possible, because you're just scaring yourself. And that's going to be counterproductive to all the vagus nerve, vagal tone stuff that we're trying to do here. But, you know, you hear that once and you latch onto it, and it can be really terrifying. But that's another one that really gets me in like the holistic space.
Well, yeah. And I think when you think, or when I think of something that's like a true toxin, it's like, are we comparing this to like a lead toxin? Like, I feel like there's the conceptualization is like, oh my God, it's like me having lead in my system if I'm not pooping this out. And it's like, well, no. Again, granted, you want to have consistent pooping habits. And I think that that's definitely an ideal goal. And I think another thing to mention too is if you've struggled with chronic constipation, it's not going to be an overnight shift either. Sometimes it's going to take time. And like you said, if you do miss a day and there's panic, that feeds into the cycle that's probably driving some of the constipation to begin with. Yeah. So just like give yourself time and probably assess motility changes over the course of like a month of like, oh, what are the things I'm doing? Is it helping kind of generally increase the days I'm not constipated? Because again, I think a lot of this stuff takes time.
Well, and to that point, I'm so glad you brought this up early in the episode. This is especially true with constipation. Mm-hmm. I mean, like realistically, bloating and diarrhea and autoimmune disease and chronic pain, like everything just takes some time to heal. But right. I think it's especially true of constipation. And if you think about it, there was the blue poo study a few years back. Remember, like you logged on to Instagram and it was nothing but blue poo posts that left and right. And the cool thing about that is that it's very doable at home. You could do it DIY. I actually did it just for shits and giggles, pun always intended. And I got the blue dye and made some muffins and ate the muffins and watched and waited. And it was a fun little experiment. My husband poked fun at me and pretty quickly told me that I could do that without the blue dye if I just ate corn on the cob one day and then waited, or, you know, ate enough of like sesame seeds and just waited. But I did the full thing. I did the blue poo. And the information that came out of that that was very useful is looking at total gut transit time and kind of comparing that to the Bristol stool scale and frequency of defecation. And for really extreme cases of constipation, and I should say, I don't mean people who poop once a month. I mean like the people with worse constipation that you and I would see clinically. Their total gut transit time, the time it takes to get from mouth to anus, can be as long as 7 days. Well, if you think about it this way, if the proposed dysfunction that you're trying to treat is in the latter part of the colon, it might take a week for that probiotic or that antimicrobial or that prokinetic or the whatever, the fiber supplement, to make it all the way down to the target tissue. Mm. And then you have to give it more time to actually do what you're asking it to do. Mm. Right. But very frequently people, and I'm guilty of this too, like I'm no angel. We all have this brain lesion, but like very often people will take a probiotic for like a couple of days or maybe a week. And then they'll be like, it's not working. And they'll junk it and move on. It's like, no, you really, again, especially with constipation, you probably need to try things for a good month at a time before you really pass judgment on it. And a lot of the better quality studies looking at things like probiotics and prebiotics are a bit longer. They're like 4, 6, 8+ weeks that they're observing these people.
Right. Right. And it's such a good point. I think it all sort of takes time. And the more I was just talking to a prospective new client who had emailed me and was like, what's your, you know, who do you have success with or whatever? They had a follow-up question. I was just like, the people that can keep their focus long-term. And that doesn't mean you don't necessarily get relief short-term at times, because sometimes you can find things that kind of help manage symptoms. But yeah, a lot of this stuff, it takes time to, you know, sort out. I even think of, you know, nutrition stuff in general. Like the one thing that shuts down motility more than anything else is probably if your metabolism is struggling. if your energy needs are not being met, or if there's some disturbance there, you know, your bowels are not going to function super optimally. So again, like, that's going to take a little bit for the body, if you've been under eating for 2 years, for the body to change metabolically to where it increases motility.
Yeah.
And again, it can be tricky, because if your motility is pretty slow and you're adding food in, you can feel like, whoa, I'm feeling pretty jammed up here. You know, I'm shoving a lot down and nothing's coming out. But I think in the long run, it typically, you know, should help. And there's things that might help that process to where it's less intense. But I still think people have to get over a hump nutritionally if their nutrition's off.
Well, and a good way to conceptualize this, because maybe people are starting to think, oh, they're broken records.
We know
we should eat enough. God damn it, Amy. But like, here's the way to conceptualize it. One of the primary notable, like Googleable symptoms of hypothyroidism is constipation.
Yeah.
And hypothyroidism is just a metabolism that's turned down.
Right.
So wouldn't it stand to reason that under eating or like under consuming one individual macro could have a similar effect on your metabolism, independent or in conjunction with hypothyroid?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that. Chris Masterjohn did a whole long, long piece on constipation. And that was one of his big points, was that like constipation is secondary to a lot of conditions that affect metabolic rate. So he was even lumping in, I mean, which I think has a couple different causes, but like, you know, diabetes can affect how the metabolism's running. Now, again, there's different things like high blood glucose that can kind of damage nerve cells and things like that. But, you know, there some of these conditions where there's like a secondary constipation is super common, you know, is related to maybe some of the energy metabolism issues that are going on in the background. He also wrote something, because like his basically end point was that energy metabolism is super important, but he had other key points in here. But he writes, which is like interesting just from a microbiome standpoint, because he talked about the microbiome side of things, but he puts it in the perspective of energy metabolism, which again is essentially like meeting your needs calorically and energy wise. He said, energy metabolism fuels the construction and maintenance of the highly complex topography of the gut, upon which the microbiome makes its home, and fuels the secretion of mucus, in which parts of the microbiome form biofilms as their homes. It fuels the reproduction and differentiation of immune cells, which regulate the microbiome. It fuels the absorption of nutrients and the determination of what is left over for the microbiome to eat. Because he was talking about how the microbiome is important for, there's an aspect of, you know, motility that's probably governed by the microbiome. Way your microbiome needs to have enough fuel, and the cells in the gut need to have enough fuel to modulate the microbiome. I think still I would not underestimate nutrition, and I've seen over and over again that just getting someone's nutrition improving can help with constipation. And I've seen some people too who've really struggled to get nutrition up and have had a really hard time resolving their constipation. So like it being kind of a deal breakery thing. So again, like if you're under eating, you're gonna have a hard time solving your constipation.
Yeah. And it's a slippery slope, right? Because oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes the people we work with, they have constipation, but they also have abdominal pain or food intolerance issues or bloating or like reflux and indigestion. They have other symptoms. And I think what oftentimes happens is that the other symptoms lead them down the path of restricted dieting. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you get to this position where you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Like maybe right. You're band-aiding the bloating and the abdominal pain, but you're making the constipation worse. But also right. The more constipated you are, the more backed up you are, that's probably going to do like funky things and make your tummy hurt. And
right.
That's going to bite you in the butt also. So it's a scenario that we've described before where oftentimes somebody will start off in a shallow hole and then they don't realize that the treatments that they attempt actually are digging a deeper and deeper hole under them. And then we get the people who are like a mile into the earth and we're trying to add the dirt back in and fill the damn hole way far right. down the line.
Right. Yeah. And I think again, it's just the foundations are going to be important for constipation too, whether that's nutrition or motility or movement or sleep,
stress,
like again, all these things are still going to be really important.
Yeah. Well, and I was kind of thinking that we were naturally gravitating to a root cause of constipation conversation, but I'll announce it formally anyway. But I want to pause on stress for a minute because this is something that I've noted in myself, and it's really interesting. I did a video on this observation on YouTube. I don't know if a lot of people have seen it. I don't think it's one of my higher performing videos. The short version of a long story is there were two times in my life recently, like about a year or so ago, that I noticed that stress caused acute constipation for me. So I'll tell you the second one first. So my mom was having surgery and it was planned. It was a big like foot and ankle orthopedic surgery. So she knew she was getting it. We knew for a while prior, but it was still stressful enough, right? Like your mom's going to be under for a while. And it was a really big reconstructive surgery for her. And, you know, just woke up early, went to the hospital, waited for her. And we were all kind of on edge, just waiting until we knew she was out of the surgery. And not surprisingly, I didn't poop that morning. Get to, you know, I think she was under for like 4 or 5 hours. And then they come and get us and they say, hey, your mom and your wife, she's out of the surgery. She did well. The surgeon will meet you in the other room over here and he'll debrief you on how the surgery went. We're like, okay, cool. No joke. Immediately, my body was like, now, we have to poop now. And I could feel it. And I was like, ooh, okay. But I had to hold it for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes because I didn't want to miss out on the conversation with the surgeon. So I was laughing because I was like, okay, well, you got to wait now, man. But, you know, that scenario made sense to me because my body was in fight or flight mode. The threat was there. Then the threat passed. And as soon as the threat passed, my body was like, okay, we're safe to poop. Hooray. And we had a big poop. We being me and my body, I guess.
Right.
So that one made sense to me. And I feel like that's how a lot of people conceptualize stress-induced constipation is like, oh, well, the stress is there. And then once the stress goes away, the constipation goes away, right? But that's not always the case. So the other scenario that I shared in this video was I was giving a lecture for a group of clinicians about SIBO. And it was a 4-hour lecture. I'm pretty comfortable in front of cameras and public speaking, so I wasn't really worried about it, but it was a stressor of sorts, you know, just making sure that my PowerPoints were perfect and making sure that I'm teaching the points that I want to teach and getting up in front of people on a stage for the first time in a few years since the pandemic, pretty much. So, you know, there was still like a little bit of nervousness going into it, even though I'm pretty comfortable with it. So, you know, I get there and I remember at least for a day or two prior, I hadn't pooped. But I was like, okay, I'm starting to kind of feel the pressure getting ready for this event. And again, mentally, I'm pretty cool and I know it's fine. It's going to go well. I'm prepared, yada, yada. But my body is telling me, no, girl, you're more stressed than you realize. Because as I'm trying to eat my lunch right before my talk started, shaking like a leaf, right? Like I'm trying to eat an apple and some nuts as a light kind of lunch before this talk. And my hand's just shaking. And I gave up. I ate like half the apple and half the nuts because it was silly. I was like, I'm not going to digest this anyway. So why even bother? So I do the lecture. It went great. You know, I got really good feedback on it, good engagement from the audience. I was able to enjoy the rest of the conference and just be an attendee and kind of casually mill around with with everybody else. And I was thinking, okay, like the threat has passed. I'm no longer in fight or flight mode. I'm totally relaxed. The event is over. Now I'm ready to go back to normal. No, it took me 2 or 3 weeks to get back to my normal baseline pooping pattern. And that was wild because, again, it was a type of stress that I wasn't mentally super stressed out about. It was just like my body was in fight or flight in the moment. But, you know, the threat passed long ago, and it took 2 or 3 weeks to fully recover my motility and my pooping after that. And that was the one that really surprised me. And I wonder with how pervasive stress is and how many people live their lives in fight or flight mode on a fairly regular basis. I just really wonder how many people have like stressor after stressor after stressor, and they never get out of that couple week refractory period. And so they have chronic constipation and they don't know what the cause is. And it's like, all right, well, if it takes you potentially 3 weeks plus or minus a little bit to recover from stress and get your pooping back on schedule, but you're having a significant stressor daily or weekly or biweekly, like you're never allowing your body to recover and getting out of that rut, right? So it was really fascinating because, again, the surgery one made more sense to me.
Yeah.
Threat gone, well, poop.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Like, again, I think different scenarios could affect people differently. One area where I think it becomes clear how stress is involved in gut function in general, but I see it a lot with constipation, is when people go on like vacations, especially longer vacations, and it's like, oh yeah, my constipation was gone on vacation. And I think there can be a number of reasons for that. And I don't think everybody has that experience, but the people that do, I wonder if stress is a big element, or there's stressors that they're not addressing in their life. Sometimes they're outside walking, like if they're in Europe, or they're on the beach, like they're outside a lot more. It's good for their circadian rhythms, good for their stress response. They're like enjoying and having new experiences.
Maybe eating different food if they're traveling abroad in particular.
Eating different foods. They're again, like I think, especially in Europe, sometimes they're walking a lot more. And again, like
Japan too. Japan's a big walking country also.
Yeah. All of which I think can generally help. I've had, again, like a number of clients who have noticed a better motility on vacation. And again, this doesn't happen to every person. Some people kind of have opposite effects where they're like thrown off a little bit because they're out of their typical routine. But to me, again, in those cases where you get a lot of benefit from a constipation standpoint on vacation, it's more evident that maybe stress is at play, or that there's some stressor that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's always interesting to see that like happen. And it always makes me think, okay, like let's look at what you did on that trip. And maybe we can incorporate more of that in your regular life. But yeah, that's what it reminded me of with your story. One other thing I will add, for me personally, I feel like historically I've had a little bit more run a little bit more on the constipation side. Like I definitely did not go every day. This was sort of before a lot of my gut issues like reached a fever pitch. When I was doing a lot of running, like high intensity running, I was not eating enough. I was much more stressed. My diet had less fiber. So like there were definitely periods of time where I was more chronically constipated. And I think once I resolved those issues where I was eating enough, not doing super high intensity exercise anymore, which to be fair, I think doesn't work really well with my body. I still do a lot of cardio with tennis and that seems to work well. But at some point it was just too much. And I didn't really know how to balance it super well because my dad's a marathon runner. So it's like, there was not a good reference point of like how much running was enough or not enough. I just couldn't really balance that super well on my own, except like cutting it out and maybe doing other more gentle movements seemed to be more helpful. But yeah, I think I think that that was a stressor on my body, you know, in general, more of a physical stressor than I think like the mental, emotional kind of stressor with what you're discussing. But
and at the end of the day, the body just perceives stress as stress.
Right.
In a weird way. So, and that's the weird thing about stress too, is like you could mentally kind of rationalize that it's not that big of a deal, but it like what I did with that lecture, right? Like, oh, I have, you know, 300 YouTube videos and 100 and gazillion podcast episodes. And like, I've spoken on a stage before, like, it's fine. I'm fine. And like my rational, intelligent frontal lobe was saying, no, it's fine. But my lizard brain was like,
everything is not fine.
That's all that mattered, right?
Right.
My lizard brain was the one who was dictating my motility in that moment. So, but yeah, overtraining could definitely mess you up. I did a bit of overtraining. I think it was the winter of my senior year. I was getting ready for rowing in college, and I was trying to improve my ERG score and like get a better scholarship and whatnot. And I just was running myself into the ground to a point where like I basically made myself anemic and just was really depleted. And my coach and my mom forced me to take 2 weeks off from rowing. And I remember being really pissed at them, but I'm glad that they did it.
Yeah.
Cause I was burning myself out and I was probably not on a healthy path. You lightly touched on something, but the obvious elephant in the room is fiber, right? Yeah. Like what's the stat that I like to repeat every episode? 5% of the American public is actually getting enough dietary fiber. 67% of the American public believes they're getting enough dietary fiber. So you do the math, and that means 62% of people are wrong, and they're living a lie. They're in denial, and they think they're crushing it with fiber when they're not. And then there's like the remaining 33% of people who are like, nah, I know, I don't get enough. It's fine.
Right.
And they're in their own kind of camp. But a lot of people, I'm perpetually surprised where I'm at my career and frankly, like how much of a commitment it is to work with me. And I'm still surprised that I still get people who are constipated and we do a quick chronometer and they're not getting enough fiber. And I'm like, well, there you go. You didn't need to pay me all this money to figure this out. You could have done this on your own. And again, maybe the trick is that a lot of these people have other symptoms and they're reducing fiber for the sake of their other symptoms.
Right.
So that is a tangled mess. But I'm perpetually surprised how many people have constipation and then they're like shocked to find out they're not getting enough fiber.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think the real, like the educational gap probably is a big thing as to why people think they're getting a lot of fiber. Just because, you know, you go to the store and they're like, oh, so good source of fiber, but is it? Like, it's not a bad source of fiber, but I don't know if I'd necessarily call it a good source of fiber. So like the marketing around some of this stuff can be very confusing and hard to figure out. But I will say again, like I see consistently as well, people being surprised that they're not getting enough fiber on chronometer, because I see it fairly frequently.
Yeah.
And again, it's such a key area to try to, yeah, it's a big deal. I think it definitely is really common in people that are like teetering on the lower carb side, just as something to look out for.
Certainly low FODMAP, any sort of SIBO diet or IBS diet is a nightmare for fiber.
Right. So, which I still think you can get enough fiber, and that's something I would definitely recommend if you're going to go low FODMAP or on some of these diets, like try to get fiber from non-FODMAP sources.
But you have to be diligent about it.
Right. You have to be super diligent about it. And I've seen like RDs who work exclusive, like do a lot of FODMAP stuff saying, you know, FODMAP isn't low fiber. But it kind of is. It kind of, like in practice, it is for most people unless they're really diligent.
Yeah. And that's the thing is like, there are ways to get enough fiber on low FODMAP. So I guess technically they're correct. It doesn't intrinsically have to be low fiber. But you're right. Like the execution of it, the practice of it, 9 times out of 10, if not more, I would say pretty much 100% of people who do low FODMAP and don't work with a dietitian, like, keep in mind, I'm saying dietitian, not functional medicine doctor, not naturopath. Right. Like, if you do low FODMAP and you haven't worked with an RD who actually has done the bone ash training, I would say there's a 99.99% chance that you're not getting enough fiber. But if you've done FODMAP and you've done it with an RD and you're trying to do the reintros and doing the whole like Monash protocol, again, I feel like maybe there's an 80 or 90% chance that you're not getting enough fiber, but there is that bump of like, hopefully the RD has coached you on it and hopefully you're cognizant of it and diligent about it enough that you do get enough fiber. But it's not like intrinsically the diet in and of itself, it's extremely easy to go low fiber on that diet. And then that's why it causes dysbiosis, and that's why it can worsen things like constipation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but, you know, I think you're dead on. Like, if you are struggling with constipation, checking your fiber is probably going to be...
Gotcha.
Just check it.
Chronometer's free, and it shows you fiber for free. Just do, like, a couple days and see what comes up.
Yeah, for now, sure.
I will say this, though, and I think we have mentioned this briefly in some other episodes. There probably is a sweet spot of enough fiber without it being too much. And we've mentioned this before. This commonly happens with vegans, but there are other people who can do this too, where we've seen people who are getting just way too much fiber, and then they're wondering why they're backed up. And it's like, well, I saw a video recently where it equated it to if you have a highway and you have X amount of cars on the highway and the highway is already congested, if you double the number of cars on that highway, the congestion is going to be worse, right? So there is going to be a sweet spot where you want there to be enough fiber to feed your microbes, give your stools some girth and some substance and like fluff them up a bit and give them body. But also don't overdo it to a point where, you know, you're just like chugging Metamucil or eating nothing but green beans, and then you back yourself up and then you're wondering why you're constipated. Like, there is a sweet spot. More is not always better.
Yeah, it's really interesting you bring this up. I have two clients in mind more in the recent past that were eating too high in fiber. One was working with a provider, and she has some pelvic floor stuff going on, and the provider really promoted fiber, which is interesting because I've worked with other pelvic floor patients where their provider was very much like careful with fiber, sometimes going a little bit lower and then increasing slowly. I don't know, again, what's the best avenue specifically for pelvic floor because I'm not a specialist in that area, but I just found it kind of interesting. But anyway, so this lady was doing some pelvic floor stuff, and she added like bran and basically food-based fiber. It wasn't necessarily like a supplement, but it was like bran flakes, like where she was getting, you know, 10 grams per scoop or whatever. And, you know, there was these different like hacks that the provider gave her to get her fiber up, but her diet was already high in fiber, so it just stacked on like an extra 25 grams or 30 grams to where then she was getting like 80 grams of fiber a day, and it was just a lot. And reducing helped a lot with her abdominal pain. It helped a little bit with her constipation. Now she has other things going on, like pelvic floor wise, but yeah, it was just like not necessarily a good fit. Now, I had another guy too, more recently, who was in the same boat. Like, he was restrictive to the point where he was mainly eating like five foods, and we're slowly kind of building in some diversity. But some of his five foods were very high in fiber, but he was eating really large amounts of them, like popcorn, and like oatmeal. So all of that kind of equated to super high fiber. And really, it helped with it for him. It helped with his hypersensitivity. It helped with his bowel function. Helped with constipation to lower that level. So, yeah, I mean, I think I think, again, there definitely is a limit. And it's just, it can be pretty problematic if it's too high. And I, like I said, I don't see that nearly as frequently as people being too low.
Agreed.
But there's definitely scenarios where people have been high, and it's not super uncommon.
Yeah, I've seen it a handful of times. I think it's far more common that people who are constipated are not getting enough fiber. But you're right, like, those cases do exist. And again, it's usually something really overt. Like in the case of somebody was already eating a pretty high fiber diet, and then they're adding like bran flakes and like way over consuming, you know, oatmeal and popcorn. Like, if you kind of Google like high fiber foods, and then you get a sense of, wow, I'm eating a lot of these particular foods, maybe I should cut back. I feel like it's something that people could figure out, versus if you're eating a pretty balanced diet and you're getting like variety of a bunch of different fruits and vegetables and whole grains, and you feel like you have a pretty good relationship with food, chances are you're not going to be overdoing it on fiber to the degree that we're describing. So
right.
I don't know if this is a big concern for everybody, but it is out there. Interestingly enough, too, I think the keto people are going to come for me with pitchforks when I say this, but there is also a little bit of evidence that diets that are high in saturated fat and like higher in dairy can cause constipation. And I know that's like grandma level wisdom. I remember my grandmother saying that dairy caused congestion and constipation, and she had no medical background. She had no reason to say that other than just like life experience. But in particular, there are some studies in children where the child is constipated and then they remove dairy and the constipation resolves. So that's also a consideration. If you've been on the high fat keto bandwagon and you're doing like, you know, what is it that people do? They just lay a bunch of like cheese on a pan and they bake it until it gets crispy. And then that's like a chip to them. and they just have like baked cheese for a snack all the time, and they say it's keto, it's good for you. If you've been on that keto bandwagon doing super high fat or quite a lot of dairy, that also can be a reason for constipation, in addition to the likelihood that that keto diet that you're doing is probably also lower in fiber, more than
right.
likely.
Sometimes, again, like, I wonder a little bit about confounding variables too. Like, if someone removes the dairy, are they adding something in that's, you know, more fiber rich? Like, again, I think there's nuance there, but again, I do agree, like, if you're just eating zero fiber, you're probably not going to poop super frequently or have good quality poops.
And to the earlier point, if you are undernourished to the point where your body is having to pick and choose what functions it's able to do with its limited amount of resources, right? Like, if you are only eating 1,200 calories a day, what is your body going to pick? Like, keeping your brain running and keeping your heart beating and keeping your lungs going, or pooping? I mean, pooping is important, but it's not as important as those other three. So your body's got to prioritize giving the fuel to the vital organs rather than helping you eliminate.
Right. Yeah, totally. One thing too, just like almost a little bit of a next topic scenario. I know you were talking about at some point how you thought maybe circadian rhythm stuff helped your motility at some point. I know that that's something that Dave Mayo at Hack Your Gut talks a lot about, how especially colonic motility in particular seems more regulated by circadian rhythms, which is always an interesting thing too. I think there's a lot of gut function that's regulated by, you know, fairly normal circadian rhythms. So like getting some morning sun, kind of getting, not having too much blue light at night, having like regular eating times, regular sleep and wake times could also help with motility as well, if that feels like it's out of whack.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny you bring that up because I sort of like had that epiphany for myself and then I haven't really prioritized it because we're all human.
All right.
That's the thing. If that was ever a mystery, like Amy and I are just human beings and we have brain lesions and we have things that we're willing to prioritize and not. And it is right. What it is. But yeah, I still have a hunch that that's a part of it for me. Mm-hmm. I haven't really focused on it since I came to that conclusion, but I need to revisit it, I think, because that little mini experiment that I accidentally did was pretty compelling. Mm. Yeah. I'll get back to you on that someday when I'm able to prioritize that. I want to bring this up too. There are a lot of causes of constipation that we're not going to have time for in this episode, right? So like hypothyroidism, we very briefly touched on. Dehydration. If you're just not hydrating your body, you're also not hydrating your poops. And that might be part of constipation for some people. Mm-hmm. Lack of movement, like movement and exercise definitely has been shown to help with constipation. So there are other things that we're probably not going to get a chance to mention. But one thing I want to just briefly mention, acknowledging that neither of us are prescribers, is that constipation is a very common side effect of medication.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are on at least one prescription. So to rattle off a handful of things, I mean, antacids, PPIs, some migraine medications, opioids, some antidepressants. How common are antidepressants alone, right? Like that's a pretty common group of medications. Calcium and iron supplements, anticholinergics, anticonvulsants, narcotics, diuretics. There are a lot of types of medications that can cause constipation. And that might mean that you focus your attention somewhere else. Like there, one easy example, I had a woman in FODMAP Freedom, I think about a year and a half ago. And she came to FODMAP Freedom because she really wanted to poop and she was constipated. Well, it came out a week or two into the Q&As that she knew darn well that the constipation was a side effect of her migraine medication. Mm. It's like, okay, I could teach you all the best stuff in the whole wide world in FODMAP Freedom. And I'd like to think that I do. But if this is a side effect from a medication that you're taking, I don't know if all of this is going to be enough, right? Like this kind of stuff can only overcome so much when we have this big sledgehammer at work. Right. So for her, we ended up focusing, and it's hard to do this sometimes in FODMAP Freedom in the group environment, but for her, it was a very unique case where I was like, honestly, we're going to go back and forth a little bit via email talking about mechanisms and targets for migraine. Because maybe the answer for you is that we need to get you healthy and resilient to a point where you no longer need the medication and that will cure the constipation. Mm. But like trying to target the constipation might not work for her.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think it's at first you have to assess whether the medication outweighs the symptom. So like, I think for some individuals, like they definitely have to stay on their meds.
Yeah.
But you might have to, I think other individuals could potentially try to wean off or figure out a different solution. If you're someone that has to stay on the medication and the benefits outweigh the constipation, your focus could then be like, how do you support motility while on the medication, which could lead to different conversations. But yeah, I mean, I think it's such a good point to bring up medications because I think it's often overlooked.
Yeah. And again, like it's not our place to tell people to get off of their medications. Right. But again, thinking through the thought experiment, again, it made more sense for this woman to target the migraine root cause stuff rather than the constipation because we knew the root. And another piece of this too is like, A, if you need to stay on the medication, you can have Band-Aids in place,
right?
So maybe you use a prokinetic or maybe you use an actual laxative. And that's maybe antidepressant plus laxative is a better scenario for you than you living without the antidepressant. And that's okay. But it's also like, I think in this scenario, you have to kind of adjust your expectations.
Right.
Is it reasonable to expect that you would be able to stay on this medication and poop perfectly and normally and have like Instagram worthy, beautiful poops every day?
Right.
I don't know. Depending on the medication, that's probably not a reasonable expectation. And you need to kind of like adjust that when you're looking for solutions. So again, like maybe you have perfect, beautiful poops with the help of an herbal laxative. Or maybe you have kind of okay poops. Maybe you poop like every other day, or the poops aren't always perfect with the help of like some magnesium and a prokinetic. So I think that setting expectations is important with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I agree. Like if you can reduce the constipation severity, like that would still be a win. Yeah, completely. And again, I think another topic that's getting more traction, and we mentioned it earlier and a couple times in this episode, is like pelvic floor stuff. I think that's way more common than people realize. Some people may even have pelvic floor stuff from like growing up, if they had to hold their pee or something, or if they got in the habit of, you know, holding their poops or holding their pee or being nervous to poop in public. Or my roommate in college was like terrified to poop in public, and then we're now living in a dorm, and I'm like, okay. So she, her solution was like basically a suppository. I'm like, this is not a good idea. We need to maybe get you over this phobia of pooping in public.
And that's not uncommon,
right?
Too, like I swear to God, this was not planned, people, but this weekend I went to a little neighborhood like wine and cheese night kind of event, and I was talking with some of my neighbors, most of whom are parents themselves, and one of my neighbors, this just came up, that her son is afraid to poop in public, or like in a public restroom, and he holds his poop all day long, and then as soon as he comes home from school, it's a mad dash to the bathroom and he has a BM, and it's like, ooh,
right,
that's really not good for your pelvic floor.
Right.
I hope that this kid doesn't have constipation or a motility problem or you know, IBS later in life because he's doing this to himself.
Right.
But yeah, that's a really common thing. I remember, I never knew that was a thing. Thank God I never developed that phobia, because that's
right,
a toughie. But I remember becoming aware of that as a thing for the first time in high school, because I think it was a teammate who like expressed concern about that. And I remember being like, oh, I mean, isn't that what you're supposed to do in a bathroom though? Like,
yeah,
if you're in there, there's one of two things that you're doing in that stall. Isn't that just kind of how it is? I don't know. Yeah, very, very excellent point.
Yeah. Well, and then if you have a baby, or like, again, you have any trauma in the pelvic floor, certain sports,
gymnastics, cheerleading, like sports where there's a lot of, you know, throwing your body around, like trampoline, like there's a lot of activities that can be hard on the pelvic floor.
Yeah.
I even wonder about running, honestly. All of that,
I wonder about running too, like... Yeah.
Pounding, you know?
Yeah.
Like your pelvic floor is going up and down when you run.
Yeah. I mean, I think that just a variety of different things that can come up in general can certainly lead to pelvic floor. I think it's definitely more it seems more popular in women, but I still think there's definitely men too. Like if they do really hardcore lifting, well, sometimes that can definitely lead to pelvic floor, like, issues. So yeah, it's something, again, if you feel like it's more of like a straining issue, and again, if you have any of these symptoms, like you had a pretty intense birth, or like if you feel like you do like hold it or that kind of thing, or if you had a history of some of this stuff, it could be beneficial to go and get assessed and just see if it's something to work on. I would say, again, like I've definitely had clients who've had really crazy results with pelvic floor in terms of constipation and kind of getting motility going and getting things kind of flowing properly. One, like literally described it as like a light switch moment for her, like stimulating certain muscles and like turning things off. Like it felt, she kind of made it seem like it felt like her pelvic floor was kind of like relaxing for the first time ever after some of her sessions. And that just really seemed to change the whole dynamic of her gut function.
Yeah. I mean, the pelvic floor is like a sling or a hammock, and you have to push the poop through the sling, right, basically, to get to the other side. So yeah, if it's too tight, or if it doesn't have tone and it's too loose and like you don't know how to activate the muscles, either of those could be really problematic. I actually think that it could be fun to interview a pelvic floor PT and like do that in season two. I know we talked a bit with the gal. Oh, I forget her name now, but I could picture her face.
Amanda Olson?
Yeah.
Like, Olson.
Yeah, we talked about, you know, the wands and that sort of stuff, but it might be fun to revisit that because it is a pretty significant issue. Yes. Now, all of this being said, I'm going to propose something, my darling.
Okay.
We've been talking for about an hour, I think, and we have been trying to keep our episodes closer to an hour so that they're easier to digest for you, the viewer, and also for our poor editor. So we could easily go into solutions and like treatments and some of the research on that, but I'm going to request that we do that as a part two.
Yeah.
So this is going to be constipation kind of part one. And then the next episode that we do about constipation will be constipation solutions. So everybody keep your ears and eyes peeled for that episode coming out in the next week or two, but I'm going to wrap us there, and we will see you right back here before you know it for that part two episode on the IBS Freedom Podcast. Take care.
Yeah.